Mary, having passed the tests of the dedicand, had had her dedication accepted and was approaching the state of enlightenment. She, therefore, left the household tasks to Martha, and quite rightly. There must be no sense of separateness in those who are upon the path, for the path has its goal in the great unity wherein all are one and one is all. Whatever is evil in the world, whatever is partial or limited, imperfect or distorted, is a part of yourself, and you suffer with its failures and triumph with its achievements. Those who dedicate themselves to service can separate themselves from nothing, but become merged in the world as it is, in order that they may dilute it with spirit. And remember, that having dedicated yourself, you belong primarily to your master and that his claim is the paramount claim. So live, so order your thoughts, so regulate your minds that the channel may be kept open, for the channel is needed. Be not too bound to the wheel of life. You are called to higher service than the service of any person. Where there is a clash of duties, follow the higher duty. We give to those who ask. Be ready to follow greater paths. There is much you discern not, both of the greater and the less of the personality and the individuality, for the individuality cannot play its part without the cooperation of the personality. Through all difficulties and dangers the work must go on, calling upon the name of the masters. And be assured of this, there can be no harm done in spite of the ebb, flow, storm and wreckage of what is personal. Trust the masters upon the bigger issue. Upon all sides will opposition flow in, but fear not. That which is eternal will overcome that which is temporal. Only those live who live in eternity. You are gathered together for service, and we have given you certain things in order to enable you to serve. Personality ministers unto personality so that the individualities may be free for higher work. Let not the stress be thrown on the personality, but rather on the individuality. There is always work for those who are willing to serve. But the work comes first and must be put first. We ask much of those who serve us, and when they give, we pay interest. We ask faith, not because we do not trust, but because you cannot understand. Before we give you the work, we test you. It is better that the empty vessel should fall to pieces than the full one. We strike the vessel before we proceed to fill it. There are certain tests which, having been taken, open out new planes. Learn that the divine man upon the seventh plane permeates all things. Learn universal sympathy. Learn to identify yourself with the universe so that nothing shall seem alien to you. Learn to see the universe reflected in yourself and yourself in the universe. Is a nation sick? So are you. Is a city sinful? So are you. There is no crime or lust known to the history of the race that is not a potentially latent in your own nature. There is not a height to which humanity has risen which is not a potentially also latent in your own nature. No human being can divorce himself from either the depths or heights of his species. Value in spiritual values, in states of consciousness. If so be you had all things and were sick, you could not eat, and were crippled, you could not wear rich raiment. And if you had all wealth and houses and had not God, the spirit of man within you would be athirst and, standing in the cornfield, would cry out upon the barren land. And if you had all knowledge and all books, and the eye of the spirit were shut, though you know all wisdom, you would not know the import thereof. And having set before you the values of the spirit, you will receive the things of the spirit. Judge not results with the eye of man, but by the values of the land whereon thou dost live. April 11944. In preparation for the forthcoming invasion, the Allies step up their bombing campaign in Europe. 75% of France's railways are now out of action. Important issues in the deeper aspects of occultism are the dual factors of land and of blood. And it is perhaps because of their power and potential in terms of the group souls, group minds and group angels of nations that they so readily become the cause for conflict. As was said in another context by a much misunderstood initiate, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood but against principalities, against powers. It is not for nothing that this passage comes from a chapter in the letter to the Ephesians devoted to giving honor to one's father and mother, the most immediate of one's ancestors, or that principalities and powers in the angelology of Dionysius the Areopagite, refer to those orders having concern with the nations. A deeper appreciation of the spiritual complexities of these matters might go some way to seeing a little further into the inner causes of seemingly intractable territorial, racial and religious conflict. Dion Fortune has already made it plain in the letters that she has no truck with religious or racial prejudice, but nonetheless there are differences resulting from ancestry, land of birth and domicile that need to be taken into account in practical occultism. In the following article she draws some interesting lines of distinction in tracing the areas of spiritual jurisdiction over the varied territories of the British Isles and Western Europe. Another factor bearing upon all of this is the place of Oriental teaching in the context of the Western tradition. Letter number 17, for April 1944. Concerning the organization and of discipline in the Western tradition. The distinction between East and West is more than a question of terminology, it concerns jurisdiction. It is therefore necessary to define frankly and carefully what this term implies. In the heights, all are one and one is all. Descending down the plains, there is divergence of type owing to divergence of experience. This divergence is due to the fact that the cosmic rays swing into manifestation in rotation, consequently the phases of evolution issuing into manifestation receive their first impress of form under different rays and are consequently different in primary type and so react differently to all subsequent experience. But because all souls have to experience all rays in the course of their evolution, there is no ultimate difference or disunity, though temporary differences, leading to temporary disunity, must be reckoned with in all human calculations. The more evolved the soul, the more rays he will have experienced, and therefore the wider his sympathies with divergent types because he has in him something of them all. The more lowly the soul, the more limited its sympathies because the more limited its experience. Nevertheless, souls are organized by types while still in their earlier phases of development, and these types are called group souls and are rooted in the earth. Group minds, in contradistinction, depend on the development of cultures and bear no relationship to place. A group soul sets its ineradicable impress on a soul that has experienced incarnation therein, and a soul that has not had that experience lacks that impress and has no part in its life. Under exceptional conditions of high initiation, it is possible to make a soul free of another race, but this is rare, and only undertaken for an express purpose, for example the re-establishing of a lost culture. Apart from this it is seldom either desirable or practicable, for a soul depends upon the group soul into which it incarnates for a portion of its subconscious background and basis, hence the problem of the crossbred. Only in the higher ranges of evolution, wherein individualization is achieved and the soul has drawn clear of its immersion in the group soul, can these problems be solved. Below that level, they are best not attempted, and the instinct for racial purity is a sound one, because of these things, which are stated in explanation. Racial types are guided in their destiny by racial angels and initiated by racial masters. The masters, however, are all brethren one of another, for at their level, there is no division into creed, caste or race. To each group of masters there is committed a jurisdiction. Originally, racial and geographical jurisdiction were one, but owing to the migrations of peoples, confusion and complication ensued, and periodically in the Earth's history there have been readjustments. There is neither occasion nor opportunity at the present moment to consider the past history of these things, interesting and valuable though they are, for we are concerned with practical matters and must adhere to the points that concern them. The Western tradition at the present time consists of those whose staple food is leavened bread, regardless of their geographical distribution, for the white race can only breed where wheat will flourish. The bread eaters are again subdivided into the drinkers of wine, of beer, and of distilled spirits, corresponding to the Latin, the Norse and the Celtic races. But because the white races have spread far afield through conquest and emigration, and overflowed the boundaries of one another and of alien races, account must be taken of the place soul as well as the group soul in calculating matters referring to racial contacts, for the group soul, being routed in the earth, acquires a place aspect with the passage of time. In the races inhabiting the British Isles we are confronted by a particularly intricate problem. Their collaterals are spread far over the earth's surface, yet retain their roots in the motherland, and owing to the free intermingling of cultures, beer, wine and spirits are equally the drink of the islanders. Thus a unified group mind has grown up on the basis of a diversified group soul, and of this diversification of the group soul account must be taken in initiating. Furthermore, the custom of giving a classical education, thus making contact with Greek and Roman traditions, and giving this only to the males of the ruling caste, makes another line of cleavage. Owing to this diversity within unity which yet retains sympathy, the Western tradition in these islands is multiform, and though initiates may find one or another aspect the more congenial owing to past incarnations or present affiliations, all can and should enter freely into each. Of these there are three distinct lines: the Celtic, the Norse, and what can only be described as the conglomerate, being that which is composed of all the different elements that have ever struck roots in British soil. The Celtic and the Norse are divided by a line drawn from the Holy Isle, off the coast of Northumbria, to St. Albans Head in Wessex. All who derive from the west of the line will have basically Celtic contacts in their deepest unconsciousness, and all who derive from east of that line will be basically Norse. Concerning the conglomerate, this may be said, that admission to one or another of its aspects is obtained by initiation, and that its varied influences prevail wherever its varied rites have been worked long enough, and on a sufficiently high level, to have struck their roots in the earth and built up an enduring subtle form. The conglomerate is derived from the various traditions that flourished among the lands washed by the Mediterranean Sea, for European culture is primarily a Mediterranean tradition, and many prefer to use the term because of the associations implied by the other associations which have no relation to its use in the mystery terminology, but which nevertheless influence men's minds. In the Mediterranean culture are included the classical influences of Greece and Rome, the Romance influences, the Egyptian influences, the Jewish and Kabbalistic influences, and the Christian influences. All of these are so deeply rooted in the group soul of these islands that they rank with the native Norse and Celtic cultures in their influence on men's minds. All these, being fused together by the flux of history, constitute a tradition of incomparable richness and diversity, permitting a wide variety of adaptations to varying conditions. Over this diversity within unity preside a group of masters whose task it is to direct the mysteries in the British Isles, with the exception of Southern Ireland, which after long centuries of inclusion in and contribution to the British tradition, has elected to contract out and be separate. That is the concern of none save the Southern Irish and calls for no comment. Of these masters, some are of one type, and some of another, but all are brethren, and between them they direct the spiritual destinies of the people of these islands, one of their number, representative of the predominant interest, being the master of masters among them. Their methods of working differ in kind but are directed to the same end, the uniting of the personality with the individuality. The differences lie in the point where the process is started and the point where the stress is laid. The final goal is unity. But as there are many different starting places, so must there be many different routes. Some of these converge as they advance, and some do not meet until the final goal. It will be observed that in all this there is no mention of the Eastern tradition. That is because there is no place for the Eastern tradition in the West in the practical workings, though its intellectual and philosophical influences not be ignored and should, indeed, be cultivated with much benefit. From the foregoing explanations it should be clearly seen why a method that depends for its working on the Eastern group soul and place aura cannot operate in the Western Hemisphere. In addition to which there are two important factors to be taken into consideration: the Eastern culture, or factors to be taken into consideration the Eastern culture, or group mind, is very much older than the Western, Those who achieved maturity of soul and initiation under that culture are ripe for withdrawal from the earth sphere altogether. Consequently, their attitude towards manifestation differs fundamentally from that of those who are undergoing evolution under the jurisdiction of the Western tradition and who are, for the most part, of a much later evolution and in no wise as yet ready to lay aside the discipline of matter. The task of the East is the liberation of the soul from the bonds of Matu by the power of the spirit. The task of the West is the conquest of Matu by the power of the mind. The liberation of the soul that has achieved this conquest comes later, and the West collectively reached many centuries ago. Yet, when the West collectively arrives at the same place in evolution, it will be upon a higher arc than that wherein the East passed through it, because evolution has advanced meanwhile. Because the two cultures are facing different ways, the younger culture facing downwards into matter and the elder facing upwards into spirit, their destinies, their duties and their methods are entirely different, and as souls are born into one or another according to their age and needs, the methods of the one are not to be exchanged for those of the other lightly or inadvisedly. Nevertheless, each can learn from the other intellectually, but the methods of the one have to undergo profound modification before they can be adapted to the needs of the other. The interchange of cultures has produced a considerable degree of the merging and modification outlook, especially in the East, which is being steadily westernized, but although the outlook of the West has undergone some modification by Eastern influences, and could with profit undergo more, being reminded of things forgotten in this materialistic age, nevertheless it will not be Easternized in the way that the East is becoming Westernized, because the future of evolution lies in the West and not in the East. To the East belongs the glory of a great past from which we may learn, but to which we may not return. The distinction is particularly marked in the difference in the attitude towards the things of the body in the East and West, though this has been modified by the fact that Christianity is an Eastern religion in its origin, even if profoundly modified in its practice. The esoteric attitude of the Western tradition in such matters is more truly represented by the Greek outlook than by the Christian, and is therefore in some degree at a divergence with the orthodoxy of these islands. It will be noted that the Greeks in their heyday developed the finest flower of human culture that has ever been known, and that it was Greek thought that re-illuminated the Western culture when it had fallen into the darkness of the Middle Ages. The mystery tradition is older than any religion that is practiced by Western man at the present day. All the faiths and modifications of the faiths which he has held, down through the ages, have contributed to its making. Each in his turn has served as a plinth for its successor. So will it always be with mankind, whose life is evolving, not static. At each change of age a great change of culture sets in, and we are in the early stages of such a change. Things will not be again as they were, a new day is dawning and workers are needed to build anew, not to rebuild on the old foundations. For this work, as always, a degree of the mysteries is thrown open to the light of common day, ceasing to be esoteric, and becoming exoteric. It is for this task that workers are needed. They must be initiates, based in the mysteries but operating in the outer world. They work under the jurisdiction of the masters of the Western tradition ruling these islands. Because of the conglomerate nature of the tradition, and because of certain special work to be done at the present time, it is not only permissible but desirable that color distinctions should not be drawn. All who are worthy to fight for an empire are worthy of its citizenship. It will be found in practice, however, that there are certain affinities and antipathies among group souls, and that the Mongolian and the African have at the present time more affinity with the Western tradition than certain other alien types. Therefore, being in sympathy, they can cooperate, whereas those types whose group souls hold divergent ideals dominate and change, or to disrupt and weaken. Neither of these things is desirable. Each race has its own destiny to pursue under its own leaders, and change can only come from within, if change be needed. But in any case, in these Western islands it is the Western jurisdiction that prevails. Those of other jurisdictions enter here as guests, and a wise man does not try to play host in the house of another. May 1944 Monte Cassino finally falls to the Allies. The approval is given for Operation Overlord, the Allied invasion of France. D-Day is the 6th of June 1944. Minus 150,000 Allied troops pour into Normandy to begin the liberation of Europe. Dionne Fortune began her esoteric development as a psychologist and over the years maintained this interest. In this letter we see perhaps her last word on the subject. She had developed a considerable sympathy to the approach of Jungian psychology, and the little book she recommends by Dr. Joel and Jacoby was used as a textbook on the fraternity's introductory study course for a number of years. Although she was well aware of some major differences between the approach the occultist and psychologist, she maintained that each discipline could still contribute much to the other. Letter number 18, for May 1944. An introduction to esoteric. I made the acquaintance of psychology in 1914 when Freud's ideas were first attracting popular attention in this country, and the opinion I then expressed, immature though it was, I have lived to see confirmed it was not in Freud that psychology would find its Darwin. Though I realized their partial truth, my common sense rejected the Freudian concepts as an incomplete statement of the nature of the soul of man, only applicable to certain types of cases, and the same may be said for Adler's viewpoint. It was not until I came to the study of the Zurich school that I found psychology which could be correlated with esoteric psychology. The works of Jung cover a very wide range of knowledge and thought, and though this constitutes their chief value for the thinker, it places difficulties in the way of the beginner. I myself am greatly in the debt of Dr. Joel and Jacoby, whose very useful book, The Psychology of C.G. Jung, provides the ground plan so necessary for the understanding of the wide-ranging thought of the man in whom I am satisfied psychology has found its Darwin, whose mind has penetrated to the real nature of man and revealed its workings. Dr. Jung approaches his subject from the empirical aspect of inductive science. He observes phenomena and draws conclusions. But there is another aspect from which the approach can be made, that of the subjective experience of the psychics and mystics of all ages and races, a body of experience that has been continually depositing a crystalline sediment in the form of the mystery tradition. This tradition is just as empirical in its way as the Jungian psychology. It too is based on observation, but the observation of subjective states by the person experiencing them, and the system of thought built up therefrom is not an inductive science but a deductive philosophy. Both systems have developed their techniques, the one as the applied science of psychotherapy, and the other the art of magic, using the term in its true sense as the method of inducing certain states of consciousness by the use of symbols, thus introducing a connecting link between the two kinds of reality, the subjective and the objective, instead of relying on their accidental impact as in the case of spontaneous as distinguished from induced experience of extended consciousness. Psychology has developed a very fine and sensitive technique for exploring the surface of the mind, and has begun to venture out into the hinterland which lies behind the coastal plain of consciousness that is washed by the great ocean of objective experience. It has acquired great experiences in the best methods of jungle warfare in those overgrown regions of lush fantasy, but of the geography of the mountain ranges that lie behind the coastal belt, whose summits rise clear of the mists of the lower levels into the higher air of eternity, and through whose gorges wind passes that lead to the central plateau where the spirit dwells, a part of all that rich realm of the hinterland and their interior castles. Psychology knows only what it can deduce from the exoteric aspect of myths, to whose esoteric meaning it lacks the keys. For its technique it depends on the utilization of the materials spontaneously produced by dreams, an excellent means of exploring the personal unconscious that lies near the surface, but by no means so effective for entering the innermost as the methods developed by mystics down through the ages of human experience and crystallized in mystery tradition and ritual initiation. The more one sees of the Jungian method of psychoanalysis, the more clearly does one realize what good use the ancients made of their intuitive technique. Their thought seems alien and superstitious to moderns because it is not according to their convention, a convention that recognizes only one kind of thinking, a thinking carried on in words. But there is another kind of thinking which is an equally efficacious instrument for arriving at the truth. This thinking is carried on in pictorial images instead of word images, and the images are combined together into pictures instead of sentences, but the pictures have their own grammar and logic in their own idiom, and for dealing with certain kinds of material they are far superior to the verbal method, though translation into the modern idiom is the final stage of the process. In both psychology and magic, the true art lies in the reduction of the material made available to consciousness, whether derived from the spontaneous dream or induced vision, to such form that it is readily assimilable by the understanding and related to the science and art of living. For this purpose, psychology has in dream analysis through free association a technique for gaining access to the deeper levels of consciousness, and in particular for picking out a given factor at will and working with it and no other, which is unknown to psychology so far, at any rate, as the published word reveals it. There may be psychologists who are occultists, but as far as my experience goes, there are precious few occultists who are psychologists, and those that are keep their knowledge in watertight compartments for the good and excellent reason that they fear that if they did not, they would destroy the foundations on which they stand. This would be true in the case of the Freudian psychology, which is a reductive psychology, reducing the building to the bricks, and then tipping a barrowload of rubble out on the lecture platform and crying, "Behold the stuff of which the vision of the architect is made." The Jungian psychology takes account of the fact that the architect builds with bricks, girders and other unpicturesque raw material, but it also takes account of the fact that edifices are not run up aimlessly. There is purpose in their building, they serve human needs and activities. The Jungian analyst uses the methods of the archaeologist, not the demolition gang. He tries to reconstruct from the stratified fragments the kind of life that was lived when Troy was an inhabited city. It is a more interesting, more fruitful, and incidentally a much cleaner occupation than the Freudian method. With Jungian psychology, the ancient mystery tradition can join hands. They may not speak the same language, but they have the same outlook. All that is needed is a Rosetta Stone bearing parallel inscriptions in different languages, the known and the unknown, to enable translation to begin and an immense wealth of data and experience to be made available for both sides of the council table. Psychologists have long been at work trying to penetrate the mystery symbolism from the hither side of the veil of the temple. Unfortunately, they made use of the Freudian reductive technique of nothing but, and the temple of the mysteries soon lay in a heap of rubble at their feet, its beauty destroyed and its significance lost. They were then able to explore at their leisure the drains and cesspools under the foundations and discover to their delight that the soul, like the body, has certain needs that require sanitary arrangements, but is such a discovery, absorbing though it may be to those who have a taste for such things, any adequate substitute for the domes and spires of the architect's vision? Nor was the secret of the purpose of such a building to be deduced from its footings even by the most careful comparison with similar structures extant today. A railway station and a cathedral are not so dissimilar in their ground plans that a person ignorant of the nature of both might not confuse them in an age that has only had experience of aerodromes. Men's needs do not alter down through the ages, but only his methods of serving them. Let us, for a change, approach psychology from the yonder side of the veil of the mysteries. It will be an exercise not without its practical value, in my humble opinion. I would say to my fellow occultists, who love me not because of the amount of debunking I have done in my time, here is something by which you can check up on your findings and learn what is true and what is not, if you have a liking for such a proceeding. To the psychologists I would say, here is no poor relation, no illegitimate child of orthodoxy, but an heir to great estates, born of ancient lineage, coming with both hands full of jewels. For the understanding of what I have to say, it will be necessary to have a working knowledge of both occultism and psychology, for I do not pretend to begin at the beginning and lay the foundations of knowledge of either science in the minds of my readers. The minimum necessary can, however, be acquired from the study of two books, that by Dr. Jacobi, to which I have already referred, and my own Mystical Kabbalah. The long article that appeared in Monthly Letters 18 and 19 is a somewhat technical one, and gives some idea of what the fraternity expected of its initiates. Jebera, as Kabbalistic students will know, is one of the spheres of the Kabbalistic tree of life that represents God in the aspect of severity, and within its symbolism are to be found images such as sword, spear, scourge and chain. In terms of esoteric grades, it relates to that of Adeptus Major, of whom, it should be said, there are not many around, although there is no lack of examples of the unbalanced expression of this divine principle in humanity at large.